It is Friday, September the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, more U.S. sanctions on North Korea, and President Trump meets with Japanese Prime Minister.
Mr. Abe does believe in his own right that it is Japan's interest to take a firm, almost uncompromising, for now, approach towards North Korea.
The aftermath of Mexico's devastating earthquake.
273 people is the new death toll given by authorities to the public as the efforts to try to find anyone in any of the collapsed building continue.
The WHO and Medicines for Africa, plus anger to forgiveness. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. On the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York, President Trump met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe about ordering new sanctions that open the door to wider blacklisting of people and entities doing business with North Korea. They include its shipping and trade networks, further tightening controls on Pyongyang's nuclear and missile program. Mr. Trump spoke with reporters after the Abe meeting.
We have had numerous discussions already today, and this is a formalization of the discussions. We've made a lot of progress both on trade and obviously, very importantly, we've discussed in great detail North Korea with also South Korea, as you just saw. So we will continue the dialogue. The relationship has never been closer, I believe, with Japan and the United States, and it will continue on with that way. I look forward to discussing some things that the group is here specifically to discuss, and we'll be reporting back to you later. So thank you all very much. You heard about China. You heard what China was doing today in terms of the banking system. That was a tremendous move, and we have great respect, and we also would like to thank President Xi of China. So that was a great thing he did.
Mr. Trump stopped short of going after North Korea's biggest trading partner, China. And as you just heard, the president did praise Beijing's central bank for ordering Chinese banks to stop doing business with North Korea. President Abe said the key is to change the course of action as well as the policy of North Korea. And in that context, he said dialogue for the sake of dialogue would not produce anything. Grant Newsham, a senior research fellow at the Tokyo-based Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells my colleague Victor Beatty Mr. Abe believes it is in Japan's interest to stay in line with the U.S.
Mr. Abe does believe in his own right that it is Japan's interest to take a firm, almost uncompromising, for now, approach towards North Korea. While he is trying to stay close to the Americans, he also realizes that and personally believes that it's in his interest, it's in Japan's interest, to take this approach. And one should never underestimate the effect that the kidnapping, the abductions of Japanese citizens has had on Prime Minister Abe and on a lot of Japanese as well. It really does resonate, and I'm not with a lot of people, and I'm not sure that they, particularly the American side, has ever quite understood that.
In speaking with an Asian analyst yesterday, my sense was that Asians on the street were appalled by President Trump's bellicose remarks that would maybe force North Korea to dig in deeper than it is now.
Well, I think there's a lot of Asians, and I think you could probably find plenty who do think that. But on the other hand, there's probably a lot that really don't care either way. But there's also the quiet undercurrent of a lot of people throughout Asia, through North to South to West Asia, who do think that this is not what Mr. Trump said. The approach he took is not a bad one. They're not likely to say it out loud. But I think there is a appreciation that it's a good thing that the Americans are standing up to adversaries in Asia. So Asia is a big place, so you can find, of course, people who will hold positions at both ends of the spectrum.
Mr. Abe in his remarks said it is indisputably a matter of great urgency. Aside from South Korea, Japan really has a lot at stake in this crisis.
It really does. And it's also worth pointing out that Japan is basically defenseless against whatever North Korea might do, largely a missile threat and someday a nuclear threat. But yes, it has Patriot anti-missile systems and Aegis shipborne anti-missile systems, but really by itself, Japan is in a fix. And that's just dealing with North Korea. And China is an even bigger problem for Japan. So this really is a problem that Japan can no longer avoid as much as it might like to, and Mr. Abe does recognize this. And I think the public at large is coming around to understanding that Japan is not immune from the risks and the dangers that one finds in the Asia region. So this is a sea change of sorts that has taken place. Oddly enough, I think in the Japanese political world, there are still a lot of politicians who have not realize that Japan is in danger and that it does need to do much more in its own defense. And that also includes staying as close to the Americans as possible.
And back to the UN, where in a speech to the General Assembly, South Korean President Moon Jae-in said, in his words, "We do not desire the collapse of North Korea. We will not seek reunification by absorption or artificial means." Mr. Moon called on Pyongyang to immediately cease making reckless choices and choose the path of dialogue. Later, at a special high-level session of the UN Security Council on proliferation called by the United States, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged North Korea to give up its nuclear ambitions.
By contrast, though, North Korea may assume that nuclear weapons will ensure the survival of its regime. In truth, nuclear weapons are clearly only leading to greater isolation, ignominy, and deprivation. Continued threats against us, the U.S., and now the entire global community will not create safety for the regime, but will rather stiffen our collective resolve and our commitment to deterring North Korean aggression.
And North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho is due to speak later today at the UN. Earlier in the week, he delivered a scornful response to President Trump's threat to destroy North Korea. Ri likened Mr. Trump's comments before the General Assembly to the sound of a dog barking. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, rescuers are continuing efforts to find survivors of that massive 7.1 magnitude earthquake that struck Mexico City. VOA's Celia Mendoza is in the Mexican capital.
273 people is the new death toll given by authorities to the public as the efforts to try to find anyone in any of the collapsed building continue. One of the astonishing announcements made today by one of the members of the rescue teams, that is the head of the Navy, the Assistant Secretary Angel Enrique Sarmiento, is that is not missing child at the collapsed Mexico City school. That has been the focus of most of the efforts, as well as the media attention. It was told to media that a 12-year-old girl was trapped in there, that she had communicated. However, he said today that that's not accurate, that is an adult, the person that is trapped in there, and that they will continue to try to get that person out alive. As of right now, the authorities are trying to secure the city of Mexico, the capital of this country, as well as all the other areas that have been affected. We have thousands of volunteers trying to gather different elements that are important for the rescue process, as well that for the families that had been impacted. The government is trying to help those here in Mexico City, as well as those that are on the outskirts. As we're speaking right now, it's been reports that the alarms of the seismic alarms have gone off in some areas. That is after we have reported at least over 20 aftershocks. One of them yesterday night in Oaxaca. They went to 4.6, not enough to get the alarms to activate. However, that might have changed in the past few hours in some areas of Mexico. I'm Celia Mendoza for VOA News from Mexico City.
And a day after Hurricane Maria ravaged the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico and the Caribbean, millions of people there face a grim period of time ahead. All of the island is without electricity. It might be months before they get it back. All of this as rescuers attempt to find survivors who might be buried in collapsed homes and other buildings. Maria follows the fury unleashed on many Caribbean islands by Hurricane Irma just about 2 weeks ago. Among the many islands affected was the tiny Caribbean nation of Antigua and Barbuda. Prime Minister Gaston Brown spoke to the UN on Thursday.
On September 6th, my small two-island state, Antigua and Barbuda, was a victim of the ferocity of Hurricane Irma, the largest storm ever endured in the Atlantic in human history. The island of Barbuda was decimated. Its entire population left homeless, and its buildings reduced to empty shells. Fortunately, Antigua and Barbuda were spared the full blast of Hurricane Maria just 9 days later. Although sustained winds of up to 60 miles per hour gave us a troubling awareness of the agony visited on the nearby islands of Dominica, Guadeloupe, and Puerto Rico, Antigua and Barbuda continue to remain resilient.
In all, Hurricanes Irma and Maria have left dozens dead in the Caribbean islands. And as of Thursday evening, Maria was moving off the northern coast of the Dominican Republic with winds of 195 kilometers per hour, approaching the Turks and Caicos Islands and the Bahamas. From there, it's expected to veer out into the open Atlantic away from land. Leaders from 15 countries in sub-Saharan Africa are meeting in Zanzibar this week with national representatives of the World Health Organization. They're assessing a major project underway to improve access to essential medicines. The WHO says medical treatment falls apart when national health systems struggle to provide these essential medicines. They found that half of all reports of substandard and counterfeit drugs come from sub-Saharan Africa. Three-quarters of these are essential medicines such as antimalarial and antibiotics. The project hopes to find prices and fix prices in the private sector so that they are affordable and is working to improve techniques for detecting fake drugs in the market. Dr. Suzanne Hill is WHO's Director of Essential Medicines and Health Products Department. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the successful efforts of the project and what lies ahead.
So this is about increasing access to essential medicines for all. Under the Sustainable Development Goals, as you know, Target 3.8 is about ensuring all patients in the communities everywhere have access to essential medicines and vaccines of good quality. So that's what this work is about.
Why are counterfeit and substandard drugs such a big problem in sub-Saharan Africa?
Even though it's a problem globally, what we see is in markets in Africa, there seems to be more penetration of substandard and falsified products into the supply chain, which means that patients at the end of the line who are trying to get a good quality medicine don't know whether what they're getting is substandard or falsified or not.
Where are they getting these types of drugs from?
That's a good question. Different types of products seem to come from different sources. And it is a global problem. So sometimes if a manufacturing problem occurs, say, in one of the big manufacturing countries, whether that would be Bangladesh or India or China, because the medicine market is a global market, that can result in problems in Africa, but also in Latin America. And we have examples of just that situation.
What type of success have you had in the detection of these types of drugs?
For the last 4 or 5 years, we've been working very closely with national medicines regulators to upskill their capacity to actually detect respond and preferably prevent the problem of falsified medicines. I think 124 countries have been trained in how to report problems with substandard and falsified medicines. And then here in Tanzania, for example, we have a pilot project running with the National Food and Drugs Authority for a mobile phone app-based detection system so that health practitioners can report suspect products to the regulatory authorities here.
Another big area that you all have been working on, and that's fixing prices so that they are affordable for people to be able to obtain the medicine that they need. Tell us about some of the success that you're having in this area.
One of the big things we see in Africa, perhaps compared with high-income countries, is that very few countries actually have legislation in place that allows them to control the price that's finally charged to the patient. And that's a particular problem in the private sector where people are relying on having to pay out of pocket for payments when there's no insurance coverage. So two countries, Mali and Burundi, have managed to introduce legislation that controls prices. And this kind of legislation is found in just about every high-income country I can think of. And what we're seeing is that starting to have an impact on affordability for patients. But I think there's a lot more to do on that topic so that we actually have to understand what does it really cost to make a medicine that is good quality. And then once we understand that, what can we do to make sure that along the supply chain, the markups don't get too out of control?
What types of medicines have you all been focusing on?
We focus initially in these countries on what are called essential medicines. These are medicines that WHO defines as being essential for having available in supply at all times for all patients to treat the diseases that are prevalent in the community. So what we see here in Africa, for example, that's sometimes medicines for malaria or for neglected tropical diseases, but it's also medicines for the non-communicable diseases such as diabetes or cardiovascular disease.
Looking ahead, how will this work continue?
At the moment, we're evaluating what we've been able to learn and what we've been able to achieve in this country. And we see that, you know, we continue to need to work in partnership with these countries and others to support the development of strong health systems and pharmaceutical systems in particular to improve access to medicine. So we'll be continuing to work on making sure there are good quality generic products on the market, for example, making sure that the policies that a government puts in place support access to those generic medicines where appropriate, and also making sure that things like the monitoring of safety and quality in the market are up to scratch and sophisticated and allow for identification of problems that need to be resolved.
That's Dr. Suzanne Hill. She is WHO's Director of Essential Medicines, as well as Health Products Department. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, who hosts the VOA program Africa News Tonight.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Germans will be going to the polls on Sunday, national elections there to decide whether Angela Merkel remains chancellor for a fourth consecutive term. Many wrote off her chances as Germany struggled to cope with the 2015 migrant crisis, but she seems to have weathered the storm and polls are pointing toward a comfortable victory. Henry Ridgewell is following the story.
In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel is known as Mutti or Mummy. Campaign posters laud her as intelligent, level-headed and determined, promising to keep Germany on the road to success. Polls suggest voters approve, says political analyst Julian Gopfart of the London School of Economics.
She always tries to absorb different positions and to go towards a consensus-based approach to politics, and that's very popular in Germany in general, I think. But then also I think what plays a very, very big role is the election of Trump, Brexit, instability internationally.
European Union leaders hope a Merkel victory will reinforce the bloc's momentum as it recovers from multiple crises. chief among them the migrant influx. Close to 1 million asylum seekers entered Germany in 2015. Many predicted the end of Merkel's political career, but she has appealed to German society's sense of responsibility.
Ich muss ganz ehrlich sagen, wenn wir jetzt anfangen, uns noch entschuldigen zu müssen dafür.
At a recent campaign rally, she told the crowd, if we must go and apologize for showing a friendly face to those in need, then this is not my country. Merkel has tried to win back voters by promising tougher immigration laws, but the crisis bolstered support for the far-right Alternative for Germany Party, or AfD, which also has put security center stage. Following recent terror attacks, the party is on course to gain its first parliamentary seats. Again, Julian Gopfert.
Everything above 10% will definitely be a success for them. I mean, you have to remember that they're only 4 years old.
The AfD could become the main opposition, depending on what governing coalition emerges from the election. That, in turn, depends on the success of the centre-left SPD under the former EU Parliament President Martin Schulz, currently polling in second place. Schulz told reporters this week, the people in this country are still listening, and every second German is still undecided who they will vote for. The world is also listening. In its support for the Paris Climate Agreement as a champion of free trade through its strong condemnation of the crackdown in Turkey, Germany's role on the global stage is growing, according to Gopfert.
You can read it in German media as well, this kind of talk, but it's not a very big issue in Germany as such. And I think Germans are very reluctant to embrace this role still, I think.
Instead, analysts say most Germans prioritise domestic stability and they will cast their votes accordingly. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And from Washington, this is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Bike sharing has been popular, but now it's electric scooter sharing in Berlin, where a startup called Emmy allows you to register online, download an app, and suddenly you've got access to 1,000 scooters around the city. Now, the app gives you access to the scooter, their locations, and a box holding two helmets. Founder and CEO of Emmy Scooters, Alexander Behrens.
He
says you drive to where you need to go and then you can leave the scooter there as long as it's in the operating area and you pay by the minute. It's not a new concept. There are scooter sharing programs scattered about worldwide, but the idea is really taking off in Berlin and Paris. Emmy plans to expand to 5 other German cities before going international. An Emmy scooter costs several euro cents per minute, or about 60 euro cents per kilometer. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In Greek, pneuma means breath and spirit. That's the core philosophy of a relatively new program in the U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland, with the same name. Pneuma combines exercise, yoga, and leadership training, and behind this program is a near-death experience that made a young man bitter and angry and then led him to become forgiving and proactive. VOA's Faith Labadus reports that Damian Cooper founded Project Pneuma to teach boys how to control their anger and inspire them to achieve their dreams in life.
Listen up, don't move. When I say switch, you go.
Twice a week, all year round,
set, switch!
This group of kids gathers at Baltimore Police Academy to participate in Pneuma.
Switch!
Most of these boys joined the program because they had difficulty focusing in school or controlling their impulses.
Up, shake it out.
Here, they exercise and meet with adults who care about them, like school principal Nikomar Mosley, who volunteers with the program.
We allow our students to engage in the different push-ups and the sit-ups and things that will build them physically, sometimes with the physical push that helps to keep their minds focused.
In and out.
Other exercises focus on breathing.
We want our young men to understand that oftentimes they're acting off of impulse actions, and they don't think about what they're doing, they just act. So what we try to do is get them to slow down. If you take a deep breath, it slows things down.
I'm strong.
I'm strong.
And that makes it easier for them to control their anger and learn to forgive. NUMA founder Damian Cooper says it took him more than 4 years to learn this lesson.
Sit! Good.
24 years ago, he was shot, and the bullet stopped within an inch of his heart. He became very bitter and angry until he decided he had to move on.
I started doing some volunteer work in a prison, and unbeknown to me, for a year and a half, I wound up mentoring the very young man who shot me. And once we found out that this was a young man, I forgave him.
We have to learn to introduce ourselves.
Finding the strength to forgive is one of the lessons Project NUMA kids learn.
My best friends have gone through this program, and they used to always fight no matter what somebody would say to them. But now they calm down to the point where you could push them, and they could look at you and just be like, shrug their shoulders.
You have an opportunity now to always get positive reinforcement.
The participants range in age from 9 to 14.
It gives the younger children an opportunity to look up to someone and to develop a big brother within the program. So it develops leadership amongst our children, and it also helps keep it diverse.
I love the fact that many of you was like, I want to help and I want to give back, because that's what it's all about.
NUMA is also engaging these boys, young and old, in serious discussions about how they can change their community for the better. Results so far suggest the program is working well.
Since we started Project NUMA, none of the young men have been suspended at all, not one.
This program is very invigorating. This program is very fun for me to be around.
Good.
Not only is it invigorating and fun, but kids have stayed with the NUMA project for more than 3 years now because it offers something many of them are missing in their lives: encouragement, moral support, and consistency.
Let's go.
For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And some sad news from the world of cosmetics. Liliane Bettencourt, the L'Oreal Cosmetics heiress and the world's richest woman, has died at her Paris suburb home. She was 94. Bettencourt inherited the L'Oreal fortune upon the death of her father back in 1957. She is survived by her daughter, Francoise, who was born in 1953. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington and hoping you have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Working with their partners in the global coalition to defeat ISIS, Iraq's security forces have made significant progress in the mission to liberate all of the territory ISIS once held in Iraq. Speaking recently in Erbil, Iraq, Special Presidential Envoy for the coalition, Brett McGurk, called the historic cooperation between the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga essential to the recent victories against ISIS, also known as Daesh. Mr. McGurk took note of the cost of the fight on our heroic partners who have sacrificed so much in this fight. The Peshmerga have suffered almost 2,000 martyrs in this overall campaign, and the Iraqi forces have probably suffered 5 times more, he said. The sacrifice from the Kurdish Peshmerga is something that we, the United States and the entire world, really honor. We extend our condolences to the martyrs and to the families, and similar condolences to all those lost on the side of Iraqi security forces. Special Envoy McGurk emphasized that the battle against ISIS is not over and pointed to the upcoming fight in the northern city of Hawija, where it is estimated that some hundreds of ISIS fighters remain in control of the city. He urged continued cooperation between the Peshmerga and the Iraqi security forces so that ISIS's hold on Hawija is rooted out in a smart way. Mr. McGurk noted the political disagreements between the Kurdish leaders and the government in Baghdad, including over a proposed independence referendum later this month by the Kurdish regional government. The United States does not support the referendum. In a press statement, the White House said, "Holding the referendum in disputed areas is particularly provocative and destabilizing. We therefore call on the Kurdistan regional government to call off the referendum and enter into serious and sustained dialogue with Baghdad, which the United States has repeatedly indicated it is prepared to facilitate." The White House noted that the referendum is distracting from the efforts to defeat ISIS and stabilize the liberated areas. Special Envoy McGurk pointed out that the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga have fought as brothers against their common enemy. It's very important that we remain united and focused on the efforts to defeat Daesh and ensure that they have a lasting defeat. This war is not over, and that's a critical message for everybody.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.